Would you mind if I put this on the speakerphone and okay, 1 second, so let me get that. Okay, are we still on?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
It is pre-Martin.
Yeah.
We had that FOMC executive committee.
Right.
That was given pretty explicit leeway to do things between the meetings, you know, and, you know, the president of your bank was one of the ones on there.
Right.
But when Martin came in, he quickly moved to get rid of that, not because he was wanting more leeway for himself, but he was really, he really wanted to, democratize the Federal Reserve System is too broad a term, but he did want to spread the authority a little more broadly.
Well, I mean, Sproul wanted basically to return to the system of the 20s where the New York Fed was the dominant
But Sproul never really had the votes to get that, you know. That was a yearning he had in mind, and he thought it was the most efficient way to go, but he never was able to. However, Martin really respected not only Sproul, but also Rouse, who I think was back a long time.
Yeah.
I know that Martin respected both of them and their market judgments, and he had his own market judgments and so forth. So I never saw him fight a suggestion that the New York money market, that the New York people at the Rouse and Sproul level made in between meetings for a way of interpreting the directive. He seemed to feel that when that triumvirate agreed, it was a lot better for the Federal Reserve System,
mm-hmm.
and that it wasn't being as open to challenge. It wasn't being as Now, my impression was they never went very far from the central tendency of the instruction by the FOMC.
The FOMC discussed the behavior of the Treasury bill rate, so they never went very far from that, did they, in terms of money market conditions?
No.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you.
The Fed funds rate could kick around. You know, it sometimes could have a 1 day or 2 day fluke.
Sure.
When some of the big banks or something have been miscast and so forth, and that they just, in
sure.
my recollection, I remember them just tolerating that.
Sure.
You know, I mean, it was gone by the next, you know, Thursday morning, they run another rate again. So it could have a 1 day spike or, you know, that kind of thing and so forth.
Yeah.
I don't remember them ever trying to knock down a spike like that. I remember, or creating a spike in it deliberately, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way I think back over that period. Money market conditions were the sort of central feeling with which they were going. Sometimes there was more reference in the FOMC discussions, and that covered more than that. But in between the meetings, it was really the money market conditions they stuck with.
Mm. I don't want to push your memory on this. That this is not the point. But in reading over this period, if there's an exception to this rule of the chairman taking some initiative on his own to interpret the directive. It would have come in August of 59, and an increase in interest rates because of a concern over capital market and gold outflows. And then after that, there was a lively discussion within the FOMC led by Abbott Mills. And from then on, the chairman...
59, that's pre-Martin. 59. Yeah.
After that, at the end of the meeting.
After Martin, it's before I showed up and was down there, was sitting and listening to it. And I didn't get there till 61.
Oh, okay.
I remember vaguely that because I was out at the Chicago Fed.
Right.
I don't know. I don't have any insight into what exactly, how exactly that was handled.
Sure. Okay. I mean, that's sort of pushing things, but just in looking over this, over the record, it seems to me that if there's a time when the chairman exercises discretion independently of the committee, it's a pretty unusual thing. But
Unless once in a while, you know, the FOMC has voted explicit elbow room to a chairman between the meeting.
And how does it do that in terms of the language of the directive? I came in with Burns, and so in Burns' day,
Greenspan got that once, or has gotten that once or twice recently, at least once. I don't recall the language of the thing, but it was one where they weren't quite sure when to move, and they gave him a. You remember, Bob?
Oh, I think maybe I know what you mean. There have been times when the committee has said we think rates should move up, but we're going to allow some discretion over the time period when this occurs.
Yes.
Yeah. With Greenspan, this whole issue has come up again because of this explicit release of the tilt language with the May meeting, and so the whole general issue of how you the directive language and who interprets it between the meetings, that's coming up again. So, but so far it hasn't come up that much in that. At least over the last 10 years, Greenspan's always called a telephone conference if he wants to change the funds rate between meetings. And he very infrequently changes it between meetings. So it's not been a general issue,
right.
But all of a sudden it is an issue again. Under Burns...
Well, because of the tilt thing, right?
Yeah, that's why it's come up.
That was partly Greenspan's doing of trying to be a little more... Or transparency to extreme, be a little more forthcoming to the general public and so forth.
Yeah,
to start including, you know, the reference to a quote tilt and so forth.
Right, but that raises the whole issue of explicitness of language and who interprets it, and so all this.
Yeah, and Greenspan's clearly led the committee into a more explicit revelation of that kind of thing ahead of the final. Minutes than any other chairman.
Mm-hmm.
Burns is no great. Was not eager to put out a lot more information.
No, but in terms of interacting with the desk over the intermeeting period, in the Burns period, I mean, the language that the FOMC that the full FOMC gave the manager of the desk, I mean, that was quite explicit and quite. Detail. Did Burns exercise much discretion over the behavior of the funds rate between meetings, do you think, other than, of course, if you're going to put through a big change, you're going to talk to the chairman about what you're doing and so on. Do you feel like he was like Volcker at all?
He didn't keep himself as close to the market as Volcker.
I mean, Volcker sort of had the expertise and the quantitative ability to sort of run the desk himself if he wanted to, and he was involved at that level. But Burns, I had more feeling, was more, once he got the language, the contingent language,
he wanted set, that. He was a bear on the language and the contingent language.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd slave some time over a word or two in that thing to get the nuance just what he felt was right. And I and others who were, you know, part of the staff involved would be working hard to tell him what we felt was a fair word to use.
Mm-hmm.
On this, fair words to use. I mean, and as you say, we were using more explicit words than before. And that was Burns' inclination. But he also felt that more explicit wording was enough control over the desk.
Mm-hmm.
And I never remember, you know, I sat on those 11 o'clock morning calls
mm-hmm.
almost all that stretch of time, and I never recall Burns walking in and listening to him.
Mm-hmm.
I remember sometimes going down to tell him about a ripple or something like that, but I don't remember ever coming away from that with any direction by him to do anything and let the desk go ahead and do what it thinks was right and in conformity with the instructions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that just wasn't his territory where he wanted to plow a lot of time.
Yeah. In terms of authority, the full FOMC, at least the voting members,
yeah.
has the authority. So in principle,
sure. That's right.
In principle, it could delegate it to the chairman or a subcommittee the way it did in the executive committee or the way it did with foreign exchange intervention. But that's never been something that's been.
Well, and as you say, as we reminded ourselves, you know, at this time when they were. They gave Greenspan the discretion as to when to make the change, you
mm-hmm.
know, some discretion on the timing of the change and so forth.
Yeah.
So that's another kind of way of doing it.
But it's very different than saying that the chairman, as chairman, has some inherent discretion to change the directive or the funds rate between the meeting on his own. You know, within limits.
I would not say that, although I must say, Bob, if something happened mm-hmm. seriously enough for any of the chairmen I've known to have felt like they had to tell the desk to do something,
mm-hmm.
and there wasn't even time to do a telephone conference, or at least there might be a telephone conference scheduled, but mm-hmm. maybe it's going to be in 3 hours or tomorrow or something,
mm-hmm.
that something seems to be done right away. I wouldn't expect
mm-hmm.
any of the voting members of the FOMC to challenge any of those chairmen's decisions that I had to go ahead and do something because of that.
Mm. Well, I think that happened in October 87 with the stock market crash. But
yeah. But Greenspan got to the rest of the committee pretty quickly, didn't he?
Yeah, that's my understanding, that within an hour or so he was on with the phone. And I think that's to his advantage in the sense that he can then say the full FOMC the full Federal Reserve System stands behind the provision of liquidity and
well, you may know the history on that one better than I, but as I recollect, there wasn't a single voice raised an objection to him doing that before mm. the teleconference.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, he did it, and they were glad he did it, and they were glad to back him up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, can I ask you some more general questions
sure.
about Fed history? We left off in 1969, the last time we talked. Let me ask you just a little bit about the individuals on the committee. Of course, 1969 monetary policy was very restrictive. However you measure it, real rates of interest, the level of market rates in and of itself, money growth, there were hawks and doves, and the hawks.
Yeah, with retrospect, it doesn't look necessarily like it was as tight as it should have been. should have been, you know.
Let's get to that. But
2020 hindsight's not very kind to those of us who were trying to tighten money, I don't think, in that stretch of time. I think there are plenty of reasons why we went as far as we thought we could. And with some divisions among us, as you say, with Hawks and Doves. But in 2020 hindsight, I could do a better job. I could come closer to the right policy than we did at that time, I think. I think we still suffered from too little and too late. A little too late. That's a personal judgment.
Well, at that point, it was probably too late, but whether it was too little in 69, I think the issue then was to whether to persevere with high interest rates until you had a real change in market psychology, or whether you should go with the gradualist policy of trying to wind inflation itself down over a long period of time.
That was essentially the argument. The Doves weren't arguing that we shouldn't do anything to fight inflation.
Right.
It was a difference, I think, between gradualists and dig in your heels and push harder. Or keep pushing, I guess I should say, would be a better way to say it.
Well, it was more like, Martin was more like Volcker in 1981, that I think he felt like you had to get on top of the speculative psychology in the markets, and it was very important what you did in terms of interest rates and your actions, and until you got on top of that psychology, you couldn't. I mean, you just had to stand tough. It wasn't like you could you know, stick with money targets or whatever and just work things down gradually. And then
that's right.
But tell me about how the people split up. Obviously, you had the Kennedy and the Johnson appointees. You had Bremer and Mitchell and Maisel, and they were, in the perspective of the time, they were more modern looking. They were more quantitative. On the other hand, actually, they paid less attention to expectations than somebody like Martin did. So
in a
way, Martin turned out to be, in his own way, modern in the sense that he was very concerned about the psychology of the market and expectations.
Modern is you know, the if you look back over the Fed history, it seems to me that we have sometimes it's been wise to pay attention to expectations. Sometimes it's been better to pay attention to the fundamentals or the aggregates and so forth. And the fact that what was coming out, as I saw, was they got called Doves and Hawks, but it was the more thoughtful of the Doves were trying to give. We're giving increasing attention to the magnitudes. And as I recall, the magnitudes were, how shall I say it? The magnitudes were behaving in a way so that the Mitchells felt like they didn't have to call for as higher rate as they thought, high an interest rate.
That's right. If they'd had a
as they thought would come from the Martin and New York styles.
I think there were two things. If you had a quantitative guide in the form of reserves or money, first of all, you would be more likely to ease. You would go from restriction to ease more quickly over the cycle. And at that point, you would have had a restrictive monetary policy measured by the aggregates with a lower level of interest rates. And I think this is in terms of what we were talking about before, in terms of influencing policy, the idea of changing procedures to a more quantitative orientation had to be related to the interest of Bremer and Mitchell and Maisel to try to change the center of power away from, at that time, Martin and Hayes and, you know, some of the hawkish presidents. They must have felt like, well, maybe that would give them a little more influence.
Well, I think the Bimmer Mitchell Maisel group was also significantly influenced by. Remember, back in that time, we had that academic advisory—not advisory. I've forgotten what we called it now, but we would meet about twice a year with the group of academics that Lee Bach would put together.
Sure, what an academic advisory group, I think.
Yeah, I've forgotten the particular label of it and so forth. But Lee was very good at getting some of the very best financial economists on that group, and also balancing the ones that are there. I mean, so we get Friedman once in a while, but we get others who are, and we'd get Modigliani on the other side of the fence, or, mm-hmm. you know, at least further away and so forth.
Sure.
And I think that not so much Friedman by himself, but the but Bach and Duesenberry. And some of the others who weren't quite as ideological as Friedman
mm-hmm.
were starting to talk more about the aggregates as something that should be paid attention to.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I know that made a difference to George.
Mm-hmm.
Because he would question those guys very much about that when they came in, and we would talk sometimes about it afterwards and so forth. So there was a gradual learning curve, I think, that was going through the members of the board who were learning inclined, members of the FOMC who were learning inclined on this kind of business of
mm-hmm.
Monetary policy and how do you step on the brakes and how do you look at it and how you measure it and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I see that as a significant contribution to why Mitchell and Bremer Maisel less convincingly, but I think Sherm was also affected by this very thing. Yeah.
Mm.
Pushed. And George was careful to do it in a way that he felt was constructive for the FOMC.
Mm-hmm.
Both Sherm and Andy had a little bigger ego quotient than George did.
Sure.
They pushed a little different, but that they were, but it was, you could feel that kind of thing going through. And
my understanding is that they did a lot for the staff in terms of keeping the staff involved professionally.
Ooh.
And those three individuals, particularly Maisel and Mitchell,
yeah.
Were very concerned that the staff be as professionally good as the best economists in academia.
You bet. And they worked hard to keep it that way. They wanted it that way. They wanted the staff to be respected that way, too.
Mm-hmm. And they were.
and they were.
Yeah.
They were. You know, that with Martin, it was kind of almost a little humorous in a way. Because Bill Martin was about as strong a defender as the staff, as anybody. He didn't blast the staff when it said some things that were different than what he thought, what
mm-hmm.
he was feeling and so
yeah.
forth. He was very courteous. He really wanted a good staff, not only at the Fed, but out at the Reserve Banks too, but particularly at the staff at the board. He really wanted, and he backed us when
mm-hmm.
we were struggling with some of these things or starting to push in certain directions. But he actually, I don't think, was ever very fully convinced by the staff about the how important the aggregates ought to be.
Sure.
So while the staff was moving gradually more in an aggregates kind of, well, never to the end, but I mean the balance within what the staff was putting forward, the aggregates were getting more attention than what the staff, gradually, than what the staff was putting forward.
Well,
and Martin let that happen. It was okay with him. It was fine with him. the we'd look for the words that would leave room for that and give attention to it. And I never had him say, "Don't put that in what you're writing," you know, or water down that kind of thing. He was always very, very accepting of what went into the record, about what the evidence was, and so that the discussion around the table and so forth and that kind of thing. But in his own convictions, you know, he gave the market he continued to give the market a significantly larger weight in his own decision making.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd sort of roll with the committee. He was very adroit at rolling with the committee, but he'd keep the committee also. I mean, it. He never completely gave into the committee. He simply sort of moved a bit and accepted some of the language and so forth that was drifting around the committee being picked up. It was the way I took it.
Mm-hmm.
And those of us on the staff who were drafting that kind of stuff for him and the committee were trying hard to do what we thought was accurate and fair. And it wasn't easy in those days to find the right words, partly because, you know, some new phrases were coming up as part of what was going on and so forth. So, but he was, Bill Martin was just as straight as a string on it would be. On sticking with the recognition in the documents and in the records of that gradual drift toward more attention to the aggregates that developed mm-hmm. during that stretch of time.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the...
He had bigger problems on his mind, you remember.
Oh, sure.
Because he was getting... I better be careful. I don't want to say he was getting. He was much concerned about the kind of pressure on the economy that the whole increased military effort was applying.
Mm-hmm.
And he was getting information from the CEOs of the major manufacturing companies that were making that stuff and that kind of thing. Besides which, we were picking up in our own statistics and so forth. Remember, he and he had his own contacts, and he was very careful that they were one-way contacts. That he would check with these reports what's going on, what they sense, and the thrust of orders and so forth. And he was trusted for his integrity. And I don't mean anybody broke security. But he was gathering input from that side that gave him a sense of that. And on the other hand, in various parts of the administration, you know, these price control, wage control ideas. And he sure didn't like that.
Yeah, let me just say this is spring of 65, and just put that on the tape. But, yeah, that's interesting what you mentioned about the price controls, because of the discount rate increase that came in early December.
Of which December?
1965.
Yeah.
That the Fed had already begun to move market rates of interest up. So in terms of...
Yeah, but I told you, didn't I, about what we didn't know factually about that in our earlier conversation? Or did I not? Did we not get to that part?
About what? About... I think you did, but about what you did not know factually.
Yeah, about the fact that Lyndon Johnson was deliberately keeping from the Federal Reserve the information about the GNP impact expenditures that were being pushed up through the Defense Department and so forth.
Right, right. Yeah, so the orders were going out, but they weren't, and that was affecting the economy, the military orders.
Yeah, but we didn't know it.
But it wasn't being...
It wasn't being told to us.
Right.
And I may have told you this once before, but I remember how frustrated Dan Brill and I, and in his own territory, Bob Solomon, were at that time by the sense that something was happening in the economy that the numbers didn't describe. But, you know, we were looking at the traditional GNP generating magnitudes, you know, the ones that mm-hmm. would end up in producing GNP.
Mm-hmm.
And none of those statistics had the growing bulge in military expenditures in it,
yep.
military orders and military expenditures in it. And the market was, I mean, the manufacturers were hiring in, and they were hiring, but they weren't hiring fast enough so that the information we had on employment was up to date with that sort of sense of
mm-hmm.
of strong pickup that was blowing through the economy. I remember one time Danny and Bob and I went over to Brookings where Oaken was. I'm trying to think of who else was there with him. Charlie Schultz.
Kermit Gordon at that point.
So I don't think Clint was in on this discussion. We particularly wanted to listen to Art because we had a lot of respect for the way Art read the economy and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
We went over and, in effect, we said to him, look, it feels to us that there is more happening in the economy than the figures say, that there's more push than the figures say. What do you know? What do you think? What are you showing up in your analyses and so forth and this kind of thing? Struggling, trying to find if there was there were analytical techniques we weren't using yet that Oaken had, or just his own judgment as to what was going on with the GNP and the upward pressure on prices and so forth, and to try to get a stronger basis on which to describe to the FOMC the strength of what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And Art didn't have the information either.
Mm-hmm.
Johnson had been very determined to keep that information.
Well, who was the director of the budget then? Was that Schultz? The Bureau of the Budget? Wasn't that Schultz?
Oh, maybe that.
So I don't think he had the information.
No.
Either.
We didn't have Charlie. We didn't have Charlie at the meeting. That's right, because Charlie was over at the Bureau of the Budget.
But I don't think he had the information either.
No. Johnson was an absolute tiger about keeping that from information. And he made it stick. I mean, it never did really. Well, I guess it eventually started the numbers, the activities, the orders began to become hires and the shipments, and we could begin to see it showing up in the numbers, and that made it much easier to justify the tightening move and continuing it and that kind of thing and so forth. But I remember there was a whole stretch of, gosh, I believe it was a couple of months when we were, those of us on the staff, we had a responsibility for making sense out of all this, were baffled. And we were operating on partial knowledge. Our instincts and sort of what we were seeing told us there was more there than there was, but we couldn't prove it. And the staff that's supposed to produce facts, you know, was... We were trying to get roots for the facts so we could tell them what we thought was happening.
Yeah.
And we did get to the place where we were telling them this. We thought there was an extra lift here, but we couldn't prove it.
You said one thing that was very interesting to me, Martin's attitude toward the guideposts at the time, the talk about controls and informal wage controls. I know that... Johnson had pressured the New York City banks to keep the prime rate down, and the cost to them of funds was either close to or above what they were getting on their loan, so they were in big trouble. And the increase in the discount rate was one way for the Fed to take the lightning onto itself so that the banks could raise rates without... philosophically... Martin disliked the ideas of controls because he disliked the idea of government intervention?
No, he didn't think wage and price controls were very effective for very long in our kind of economy. Mm. And he hated to see them drawn into the picture.
Mm.
That is, uh, uh, it, he thought they would, that was basically it, you know.
So philosophically, he just disliked.
Yeah, philosophically, he disliked this kind of control. Mm. He's too pragmatic a person to stand on that ideology and act on it, but he disliked them. And he was made uneasy by the increasing sort of talk about that kind of thing.
Mm. Well,
that was coming around. He thought tightening monetary policy was a better way of dealing with it.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I want to bring that out, because
people
who are philosophically interventionists think, well, they can use these sorts of controls as an alternative to monetary policy. But if you don't feel that way, if you have a visceral dislike for government intervention, then you're much more likely to say monetary policy is the instrument for dealing with inflation, and I think you're likely to get better monetary policy.
Yeah, no, that's what it is. And he began to let the... Well, you saw the write-up in the booklet about the conversation he had with Johnson. He was trying to tell Johnson they were going to be raising interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
Johnson used every argument he could think of to try to slow Martin up.
Yeah.
And Martin slowed up just enough so that to keep Johnson from blowing up. But that crack when Johnson says, "You wouldn't do it while I'm in the hospital with that gallbladder operation, would you?" And I thought Martin's answer was the most neatest and most adroit.
Yeah.
He says, "No, Mr. President, we'll wait till you get out of the hospital." You know, it's a 3-day operation. for him to be in the hospital for something like that.
Yeah, well, what I read was that Martin said that, "Well, Mr. President, I had my gallbladder out and wasn't all that bad."
he might have. I don't know.
Why not go ahead and just do it?
Have I told you of course, that Johnson called Martin down afterwards?
Right. Yeah, and you told me about the metaphor with the rock and the Paternales River.
That's right. That was sort of the way that Martin saw the need to get, the holding the prime rate down was creating these kind of things. And raising the discount rate that would let the prime rate go up would actually help the flow of credit improve.
Mm. I have the feeling, just kind of reading back into the record, what must have happened, but Martin went down to the ranch, and he had a long walk with Gardner Ackley by himself, and I think the two of them...
At the ranch?
Yes.
Yeah, Gardner, I remember Gardner saying something about that, yeah. Go ahead.
There's no record of what they said, but I had the feeling that from then on, Martin and Ackley and Fowler were very much of the same mind of what government should do about fiscal policy, and so that... the three of them were really sort of working as a team in terms of trying to get Johnson to propose a tax increase to counter the war expenditures, and so there was
pay for them, Yeah.
So that's what set off the sort of long sort of back and forth on monetary policy that Martin was willing to hold off as long as he thought he was really going to get a tax rise, and then he kept just being disappointed about, like everybody else, about how long it would actually take to get a tax increase.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
In 69, when Nixon comes in, Martin doesn't resign because he's just concerned that Nixon's going to do the right thing on fiscal policy.
Remember, Martin is a strong institutionalist,
Mm-hmm.
And he had a term as a member and a term as a chairman that still had some time to run.
Yeah.
And the institution was set up for its chairman to have those terms because that was thought to be in the best long run interest of the way the institution functioned.
Mm-hmm.
And resigning would be, in effect, the departure from the kind of terms that were thought to be in the best long-range view of the system. He had a real feel for the system as a system.
So he did the same thing with Kennedy then. That's my understanding.
I think so.
Because I'd heard different stories on that, but in interviews, what the Walter Heller said was that Martin did not want to resign for that reason. He didn't think that if the president got his own man right after the election, he thought that would be political.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Of course, they didn't want to let Martin. It turns out they didn't want to let Martin go because of the gold problem. But
once they waked up to that,
yeah,
because I mean he was as essential to the resolution of the gold problem as we think of Greenspan today to the working on some of these things. I mean, not only in this country but in other countries as well. If Martin's judgment on that gold thing was really impelling.
Yeah. Do you think in 69 Martin felt like he was flirting with recession, that monetary policy might push the economy into a recession, and he was willing to go through it?
I don't think so. Now, let me see, Bob, what I can conjure up in terms of it. I mean, see, by the end of 69, by 69, we had a good reading on this military upthrust in the economy. And maybe we weren't getting the very latest numbers, but we sure could see the trends and could have a sense of what was going. And I believe that if one of us had asked him, he'd have said, no. He said, there's so much upward pressure coming from that military spending that recession is not a serious risk. The problem is to hold down the risk of inflationary excesses coming because of it.
Yeah, I think...
I think that's the way he read it.
Yeah, I think that's right, except that in 69 the issue was whether Congress was going to extend the tax surcharge, and he was very much concerned
that
he was first very concerned that Nixon wouldn't ask for the extension, because in the election Nixon had said he wouldn't. But then when Nixon came around to supporting the surcharge and sent it to Congress, Congress made it into sort of a Christmas tree of tax reductions for everybody. It got mixed up in the idea of reform, and Congress interpreted reform as tax reduction. So I think Martin was very concerned that the deficit would reemerge.
But that's not a recession problem. I mean, that's an inflation problem.
Well, that's right. But that's what you're suggesting to me, that Martin wasn't just thinking he was thinking that inflation might get loose again in 69.
Yes. Yeah.
And Martin was of the generation, and maybe this is right, that if you let inflation get loose, then you're going to have a recession. It's going to follow. That's the correct
answer. Well, but I wouldn't put it that way.
How would you put it?
That is, there are people from that generation who, you know, if it is a business cycle type of thing,
mm-hmm.
And the business cycle, and you know, the normal traditional business activities well up, and then it's reasonable to expect them to go back. And there were people there with a business cycle kind of thinking about it, and maybe Bill had some of that in him. He made money in the stock market on both going up and going down. Not many people. I mean, he read that stuff pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
But this push from the defense spending is not, it's an entirely different order. That's mm-hmm. a kind of inflation problem that's not cyclical.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, it's not reasonable to look to expect there to be a quick, an early downside that comes on the other side of that and so forth. There wasn't, I don't remember any talking about cutting back in government spending or cutting back in that military stuff and so forth.
Mm-hmm. This is not a first-order question, but I'm just curious because of your personal relationship with Governor Robertson. He was originally a populist, and in 65, he was among the individuals that was unwilling to raise the discount rate. And Martin had to worry about the Bremer and Maisel and Robertson.
Yeah.
You know, he couldn't move. He couldn't raise the discount rate until he had gotten you know, a majority, and that came with Dewey Dane. But Robertson changed over time. By the end, by 72, he wasn't populist anymore. He was very hawkish on inflation. Do you have any recollections of kind of talking to him and how he?
I think Robbie didn't like inflation and he wanted to fight it. I think in that 65, but Robbie was a guy for whom facts were important.
Mm-hmm.
And in that 65 thing, including all the way through that, at the time when that interest, that discount rate was increased, there was not facts on the table that supported that discount rate increase.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't the facts on the table that supported it. It was the sense of the new euphoria in the markets and these things we couldn't measure. That it turned out indeed were going on, orders going out all over the military world and so forth. And see, Robbie didn't get that information either.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted evidence on which to base an increase, you know.
Sure.
In facts. And the board didn't have them at that time. The system didn't have them at that time. But when the inflation began to show, and it was showed in the numbers, not just in somebody's expectations or forecast, Robbie moved along pretty quickly, as I recall, in his voting record. I was writing his statements or drafting statements in the spirit of what he said he wanted to do. I'd sit and meet with him, and we'd tell him what I thought was happening, what I thought the numbers were doing. He'd tell me what he'd think about it, and I'd oftentimes give him a short drafted piece that sort of said what seemed reasonable to be made, and we had a pretty good working relationship. But as I was aware of his feelings when I drafted mm-hmm. that stuff for him, but I also knew what I thought was the right economic analysis, and tightening direction. I'd always tell him that it was there. I said, it seems to me that kind of stuff is there, and so I've cast the language in this fashion.
Mm-hmm.
I tried never to surprise him, and he took it like a man. I mean, he trusted me, and mm-hmm. I tried never to give him a curveball.
Mm-hmm.
But as I recall, once the evidence started coming in, he pretty well got on board. However, getting on board on the basis of the evidence meant we were doing some things, as the phrase I used a little earlier, a little too late and a little too little. And because Robbie was a facts man, he was part of the little too late and a little too little.
Mm-hmm.
And he had quite a bit of company.
Well, yeah. So let's talk about Arthur Burns. He comes in February of 1970, and in a way he could make common cause with the Brimmers and the Mitchells and in the Maysles, even though they were philosophically different. They both attached a lot of importance to the real economy as opposed to the psychology of the markets, and so. Burns really had, he dominated the FOMC, but apart from the people like Hayes who were more oriented toward the Bretton Woods system and the value, external value of the dollar and so on, Burns had a common core of support within the governors and...
with the presidents, too.
Mm-hmm.
So far as monetary policy is concerned, you know, they all respected him as an economist and what he understood in his own right. He found a couple of economists who he could really work with that as he went ahead, and Chuck Bartee and Lyle Graham, they were creating the research division in terms of what was going on and so forth and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Arthur met with, particularly the earlier part of his name, met with him a lot and listened and talked to him and so forth. Didn't hesitate at all to ask pointing questions. I don't know. I wasn't in all those meetings, but the guy, neither of those two guys ever gave me the impression that he tried to push them around and make them mm-hmm. produce a different report
mm-hmm.
than they thought. He may have said things like, go back and look at it again or something like that. Mm-hmm. See if some of these other numbers jive with what you're saying too or something like that. But he was respectful of them. And I was on the money market side at that time, and he never pushed me on that kind of thing. I'd tell him what I thought was happening and what was going on, and as we tried to work on the matter. By the time Burns was in, I remember thinking it felt to me like the Hawk Dove division within the FOMC was, as I'd say, was narrowing. I guess what I really mean is that the way each of those sides read the market were not as much, read what needed to be done was not as wide as it had been at some time in those in the late 60s.
I think that's right.
Let's see. We picked up another new governor along there too. Before long, I've kind of forgotten when the timing was on this kind of thing.
Well, toward the end of the 60s, there was Sherrill, and then as you get into the 70s, you get
Wallach, don't we? Right in there.
Yeah, Wallach, and well,
when did Wallach come? Anyway.
Oh, I don't think he comes until the mid 70s. You get Buer and Sheehan before you.
Oh no, Wallach was there for several years while I was still there. It was not the mid. Wallach was there before the mid 70s.
Well, it definitely was not before 73 or 74. So I think it must have been then 74, 70. If it was before the mid 70s, it was 74 then, because he wasn't there in 73. He was still at Yale then, I'm sure.
Well, I trust your recollection.
Yeah.
If I had operated off my impression, I would have said I thought he was there at least a year earlier than that.
How long were you a governor, and at what was your last meeting?
Well, I wasn't a governor until 73.
Right, but
my last meeting was 76. But I remember when we went out to get Henry Wallach and doing the background studies for it and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember how it seemed like his kind of economic understanding would be a real help to the board,
mm-hmm.
A real help to the committee. And boy, it seems to me, I was still an executive director and sort of Burns' right-hand man when it came to digging around with these nominees.
Mm-hmm.
And, I thought I started some of that conversation about Wallach in 71.
Hmm. Well, I'll check that.
And that maybe it was 72 before he got in. But Burns negotiated with Nixon fairly early on. An understanding about new appointments for the board. Do you know about this?
No.
He wanted to get good people on the board. He did not want political turkeys. He wanted good people on the board.
Sure.
And he knew Nixon well, of course. He'd been his economic advisor before. And Nixon trusted Burns. So Burns thought up a procedure that he thought would be very good for the Federal Reserve System and good for Nixon. And he got Nixon's okay on it. And that is that when an opening on the Federal Reserve Board appeared, Burns, with his resources in the Federal Reserve Board, would bring Nixon a nominating list of three people from which Nixon would choose the person to be appointed. Burns said he guaranteed next to Nixon that all three would be good, well-qualified people who would not be a political negative for Nixon. That is, in effect, that's the way he put it.
Mm-hmm.
I thought Henry was the first nominee under that negotiation. Because I remember talking to the guys in the White House who were the White House's staff that was assigned to work on the nominees for the Federal Reserve.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember telling them about the names who were coming up, and we would talk back and forth about their qualities, what it should be. That it was actually a pretty friendly exchange because Burns had a sharp eye for the kind of talent he thought the board would benefit from, and that would also redound to the respect for Nixon. Not that
mm-hmm.
redound to Nixon's reputation as an appointer of good people
sure.
on the board.
Sure. Well, did you so in terms of the people you were talking to at the White House? Did that include Peter Flanagan?
No, I usually talk to press. What was his last name? Press.
Martin came later.
And I've forgotten who it was I talked to before Press.
Hmm.
I don't remember how soon Press got there.
There was a guy named Cole who handled.
I guess I talked to Cole before.
Ken Cole,
that name
yes.
sounds familiar.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they were the exchanges between us were friendly and professional. They knew about the understanding between Burns and Nixon, and we served them up very good choices. They'd look at them, they couldn't find a thing wrong with them. They'd be three very good choices. I think Burns usually let Nixon know which of the three he preferred, but there was always a list of three, and Burns says, you can take any one of the three, and I will support it and support you and so forth. I will guarantee you they will all be really good people.
Hmm. I'm just curious that in terms of the White House staff people you interfaced with, did you have contact with Peter Flanagan, and what did you think of him?
No, Flanagan was the next notch up.
Mm-hmm.
I think Press Martin, maybe he reported to Flanagan on stuff like this.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't have to deal with Flanagan. I, the truth of the matter is I didn't trust Flanagan. But I was very glad I didn't have to deal with him. I'm not sure. Not much of my distrust came from any direct contacts with him or even orders that came down from him. I didn't like what I heard from others. I didn't like what I read in the paper about him and what he was doing. I didn't like his relationship with other agencies, the way he dealt with it and so forth. I was pretty, in my own mind, I had a feeling Flanagan was not a person who acted in the best interest of the agency he was talking to.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was thankful not to have to deal with him.
He had no respect for Fed tradition.
My impression was that was that ranked pretty low in his priorities.
Mm-hmm.
I did a lot of talking to Press and to some extent to Cole before about the system, why it was the way it was. Yes, it's politically awkward in a number of respects and not can't be too efficient, but the reasons why the structure is like it is rooted in painful American history, in good political science with 20/20 hindsight, and so that's why you have to put up with the Press kind of thing.
this subject, in terms of the language that the Council of Economic Advisers included in the 1970 and 71 economic reports of the president, where they wanted to make strong statements that monetary policy would support, well, in the second case, 1065 GNP, where they wanted to be very explicit about money growth targets, much more explicit, of course, than Burns was willing to be.
Yeah.
You know, rightfully, I mean, not wanting that to be sort of a backdoor way of giving instructions to the Fed. So would Burns have negotiated those differences with the Nixon himself and then settled that sort of issue?
I don't know. But it would be... It would be within his capacity to do so, and he didn't like that intrusion into the Fed's responsibilities by a council that didn't have the responsibilities that the Federal Reserve had. That is, in effect, he thought the council was making some advice that not have to suffer the consequences that the advice was wrong, and therefore they could be a little more forthcoming on all this. And he, who knew full well over some of the flaws of that measurement of the market, of the monetary magnitudes and so forth, thought they were being, well, I don't want to say I'd start to say unfair, that's not right. They were taking a position that for they were not constrained by the responsibilities of what would happen if their position was wrong. Yeah. And he felt very cleanly, clearly about that. So I wouldn't be surprised if somebody handed you a note or told you that there was a tape that said Burns went over to the president and said, now look, I know the council, I know those people, I know this thing and so forth. They're saying something that is intruding into the independence of the Federal Reserve, and I want you to know that I object to it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he I don't know that he said it, but he sure had a relationship with Nixon on the basis of which he could say it, and he had feelings about that statement by the council that would, make him unhappy about it.
Sure, absolutely. Well, just before we get back to sort of straight economics, just one, as long as we've raised the issue of interfacing with some of Nixon's subordinates, the thing that came up in July of 1971, where Colson circulated the false rumors about Burns wanting a pay raise, and at the same time the Nixon administration was floating rumors about restructuring the Federal Reserve System, adding governors and so on. Did you get any stories about, you know, what kind of initiate, what precipitated that? I mean, why would the Nixon people think that such a clumsy sort of attack could have any influence?
That's something I don't know anything about.
Yeah, okay.
It surprised me too. I don't know anything about it. Mm-hmm. Or what led to it and so on.
Mm-hmm. You know, Burns became chairman in February of 1970, and sort of over time through summer of 1971, the level of disagreements with the administration over a number of things grew. Initially, there was not a lot of disagreement, but by May of 1970, it was pretty clear that there was going to be a recession. You had Penn Central. People became concerned about recession. That fall, the Nixon administration becomes concerned begins to become concerned with money growth and whether it's high enough. And then you get, it seems like you begin to get a fair amount of disagreement. It really starts with the 1065 GNP prediction by OMB and the council, and whether you're going to get money growth to achieve it. I mean, so you know, sort of in spring of 71 now, Burns wanted a strong economic recovery, right? But he wanted it in a way he thought that was sustainable. He felt like he had to do it in a non-inflationary way, that he was concerned about getting a restoration of confidence on the part of businessmen so they could feel like they could invest and get a return from that without their cost rising, without wage growth impinging into their profits. So,
well, he didn't mean just interest rates.
Right.
Interest rate cost. He had in mind real costs.
Right.
Yeah.
So did you... So there were two points of disagreement with the administration. One was over the level of money growth. The other was over the role of an incomes policy and the role of the president in terms of influencing wage and price decisions. Do you remember discussions at the time among the governors at board meetings on the issue of wage and, well, they weren't in incomes policy and moral suasion? They hadn't moved to wage and price controls then. Was there pretty much unanimity with Burns's position on that issue? He gave his first speech on this was in May of 70 before the American, I think it was American.
Remind me of the flavor of that speech.
Well, there was that speech, and then one that got a lot even more publicity in December of 1970 in Pepperdine College. The flavor was not wage and price controls. The flavor was that the president should exercise a general sense of private responsibility for controlling wages and prices, and that the president through his office could exercise an influence on a rise in wage rates that was unrelated to kind of economic fundamentals in terms of unemployment, excess capacity, and it was more again, it wasn't controls, it was more to have a wage review board that would flag excessive wage and price increases to bring public pressure to bear, and then in unusual circumstances to have the president himself sort of set the tone for what was acceptable.
Yeah, well, you know, at that stage of the game, I mean, mm-hmm. I think in Burns's mind that was a lesser of two evils.
The
its price and wage controls were worse.
Mm-hmm.
He had some confidence in the ability of really perceptive, fully informed leaders to help the rank and file of business leaders perceive what was in their longer run best interest.
Yeah, I think you put that in a very perceptive way in terms of getting inside Burns's mind and kind of what the role he thought a president should, the kind of leadership he thought president should exert.
He felt the same thing about himself as a chairman of the Federal Reserve. That although he was careful not to get himself crosswise with the things, but he would talk a bit that way too, trying to help business leaders he would meet with understand what's economically a sounder way of dealing with the situation and so forth, by what they do, you know. And he didn't relish an alternative of squeezing monetary policy a lot tighter than it was. And he was smart enough and had enough of an ego so he did not exactly relish that being the first massive action he is famous for as a new chairman of the Federal Reserve. So, you know, he was, if by sharpening the mind, that the perception of business leaders, then it's better not to push these things up right now, or push them up very far and so forth. If he can get that across, then he won't have to raise, we don't have to tighten up monetary policy.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I don't mean he was convinced that monetary policy would shut it off right away, but I mean, that's the alternative. And it was one he had to think about, we had to think about, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That was a nasty time, you know. There was, as people were trying to, a number of different interests for a number of different reasons, they're trying to do something to hold down inflation other than a traditional anti-inflation program.
And do you think Burns related that to the fractures and the stresses of American society at that time, in that
to some extent, yes.
The combination of the civil rights movement and the way that had split the middle class, and also the way the Vietnam War protests had split the middle class, that he felt like, given the deep divisions in American society, that it was important to get through this time without a recession, and you know, to have
also that, without a sky high set of interest rates trying to hold down inflation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He didn't want either of those, you know.
And do you think he felt that Nixon needed to exert leadership on these issues, and that he needed to, yes.
I think he also thought it could be an opportunity for Nixon, that it could be politically advantageous for him with 2020 hindsight if he'd stepped out and been that kind of a leader and it carried the day with the country, that kind of thing, and so forth. You know.
And, I mean, Burns didn't necessarily trust the close advisors of Nixon, I mean, especially after the end of 70 with Connally. So Burns had strong public disagreements with Nixon, but he never pushed them to the point.
Why do you say strong public disagreements?
Over the incomes, issue of incomes policy, there was a tension between them. Burns was willing. Burns was willing to go public.
I thought your emphasis on he expressed a lot of it privately,
mm-hmm.
and I thought he expressed more privately than publicly.
No, I'm sure that's okay.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. But he always felt it was important to maintain a personal relationship with Nixon.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And he would oftentimes try to give Nixon advice in the role of a personal advisor,
mm-hmm.
to Nixon as a president. And Arthur also would once in a while try to take some of those political considerations into account, too. Not in the monetary policy, but in terms of what he talked to Nixon, what he said to Nixon.
Mm-hmm. This is sort of tangential, but it's part of a bigger picture. Do you have any sense of how Burns felt about the war in Vietnam?
No, I don't. By the time Burns came in, you know,
it was winding down.
It was winding down. The numbers, we weren't suffering not being told what was going on,
right,
that kind of thing, and so forth. The way that Martin had to wrestle with, there wasn't that kind of problem. I have no doubt Burns had a private attitude about it, but right now I don't recall any expressions that I think I could tie to how he felt about Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let me ask you.
Glad it was winding down. I mean that.
Oh sure.
That made the problem of monetary policy a lot easier. Yeah. Well, see, not easier. made the path we might have to talk with monetary policy, deal with in monetary policy, a lot of these, quite a bit easier than if we were continuing to write that doggone surge of military orders, you know.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about the several months before the November 1972 election, and kind of let me tell you what I'm getting into. You know, I'm you know, working on this history, and I'm going to write it up. And you and I both know that Burns was not partisan political. He was politically astute. He attached a lot of importance to maintaining good political relations, not just with a Republican White House, but with a Democratic Congress, and that's, you know, hardly partisan. But there are people within the Federal Reserve System who were on the FOMC at the time, and staff people who did feel like he was political.
I know that.
And of course, later on,
I'm not one of them.
I know, that's why I say that, and I'm not either. Before I didn't know, but after kind of getting into reading the minutes sort of line by line and everything, you know, I'm not either. But I want to, when I write my book, I want to get this straight, so that when people come back to it, they won't sort of pick up, White House memos and letters that Nixon wrote Burns and stuff, and sort of fly off with those. So I do want to go through the period before the elections and talk about how you see Burns and how he's responding. I think there's sort of two periods here. One is pre price controls and one is after the price controls.
Yeah.
And after the price controls, there's no longer any public disagreement, but Burns is very much interested in influencing administration policy. I mean, as I read it, he very much wants a wage guideline that moves down over time from 5.5%. So he really wants to wring inflation out of the system. He wants to go to price stability, but he sees the wage guidelines, the 5.5%, as key. Does that sound at all right to you?
Well, I remember he wanted the wages the wage thing to work down a bit. To some extent, well, there's a couple, three different things working here, I think. Burns had a... I'd never seen him... I never saw him play what I thought was a clear partisan card in monetary policy. He was aware of the standing of the administration and with society, and he was concerned about whether society would accept price controls, how long it would accept it. I mean, as an economic analyst and a person who had in his earlier incarnation done some advising in this kind of direction, and he was quite alert to the lessons of World War II, where we generated a huge uprush in military orders and the military demand to use American real resources, put a lid of price controls on it in the spirit of patriotism, and we got all the way through the World War II with it.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew that. He also knew the history of how it was unwound, and it wasn't all that comfortable and all the rest. But he knew there was a point at which the American public might, for national or patriotic reasons, be willing to put up with some kind of controls. He hoped the voluntary controls would capture the public's loyalty and response, and they didn't, at least not enough. He also was concerned with the place of that the Federal Reserve had in the public eye and in the eye of the Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And Reserve in ways that he and a lot of other Federal Reservers thought would be wrong. And so he was trying to not give them enough more fuel to throw on the fire to make it really, uncomfortable or even likely that some of those other laws would get passed.
I mean, you're talking about Wright Patman and the GAO audit now and...
Gee, who were some of the others?
Well, Royce and Patman were the ones that made the most noise.
So was Henry, the representative from Wisconsin. What was Henry?
Well, Proxmire was the most articulate critic
but,
of the
but
fact.
But Henry was...
But Royce, Henry Royce.
Also was...
He was the Democrat from the Milwaukee area.
And he was smart, and I mean, he wasn't just throwing garbage around. So there were people in Congress quite willing and eager to do some things to the Federal Reserve, and Burns didn't want what they wanted to do to be done to the Federal Reserve. So he was attuned to the politics of that kind of treatment by Congress of the Federal Reserve. In the larger sense, in terms of general public attitude toward the Federal Reserve. One other, those were considerations in his mind.
In December of 1971 and also in March of 1973, in the first case where Congress was passing the authority for the wage controls, and in the second case, where it was extending them for a year, and you got the two-tier prime business. Did Burns feel at those times or any other time that Congress might extend the controls to interest rates? You don't have to know the answer to that question, but did you have a sense that was ever a concern?
It rings a vague bell, but I can't. Mm-hmm. I don't know quite. Quite how to take that into account.
Well, do you remember the two-tier prime and the?
I remember that.
So Burns felt that if he didn't do something about interest rates to businessmen and farmers, that the controls might be extended to.
I think that had something to do with it, but mm-hmm. I've got to be careful now because now I'm starting to guess. I don't have I don't have direct knowledge of that. So I don't know where Burns got his advice from within the Federal Reserve on that.
Mm-hmm.
That may be something that was pretty much his own idea as a compromise, feeling that something had to be done and that was better than the alternative,
mm-hmm.
both in terms of initial action and in terms of its subsequent effects. He was a pretty good soldier once those controls were put in place. But they were distasteful to him. You know, he's basically a free market economist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But he did think that they would be effective in controlling inflation.
But which?
The controls.
The price controls?
Yeah.
I'm not sure the answer to that is yes.
Hmm.
I think he was a loyal supporter of them once they were enacted. I mean, he didn't decry them.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he was too good an economist to think that that'll work out fine. He had a little hope. He had more hope, I think, for the volunteer stuff than he did for the fixed controls, because he thought the volunteer stuff might be able to develop the voluntary limits might be able to develop some of that American patriotism that helped us in World War II.
Hmm.
I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I'm sure that's the way he felt about voluntary controls. And I think he thought chance of commanding that kind of patriotism than strict fixed controls. Hmm. But when the fixed controls came in, you know, he was a loyal supporter, and we ran some of those records, some of those polls ourselves, you know. And members of the board for whom controls were distasteful accepted the role of being chairman of one of another of the control systems, and they did a damn good job of it. I mean, they meant to do a really good job of it, and they mm-hmm. did. Mm-hmm. I mean, administratively.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, Louis Robertson ran a heck of a good program, you know.
What was his involvement in the...
Wasn't his the voluntary foreign credit restraint?
Yeah.
One, I think that was his, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He had one, Andy had one, yeah, they, you know.
Yeah. Okay, so let me ask, again, I mean, I think you and I are in agreement on this, but still, I can't just state my opinion and have people believe it. I want to understand, you know, what was motivating Burns. And of course, the period that people point to, who feel that Burns was, that policy was influenced by a desire by Burns to see Nixon reelected. They point to the summer of 72, and in particular in July, money growth began to come in very high. And the Fed had these quarterly money targets and then monthly targets. And initially what they did was to rearrange them so that they would have very high growth in July with almost no growth in August. And so, in effect, kind of accommodated the high growth in July and hoping that was
a blip. This is
This is July 1972. 72, right before the election.
Yeah, I'm just trying to... Yeah. Just a minute, and I got somebody to do it.
Okay, sure. Keep you forever.
Yeah, I've got to get this
up. Yeah.
Go ahead.
So, initially the FOMC set the money targets to accommodate high growth in July and had kind of targeted minimal growth in August, but through August money growth continued to come in high, and then through September. And when you read the record, Burns is the FOMC did move interest rates up, but very reluctantly, and Burns is very reluctant to move rates up. It's clear they're going to miss the targets. And in September, the markets realize that the money targets are being kind of overshot, and the markets anticipate that rates are going to go up. So, you know, knowing Fed procedures, so they do move rates up. And Burns in September, right before the FOMC meeting, Burns or at least it must have been done with his knowledge, the desk actually moves the funds rate down to limit the rise in market rates. And there is a lot of tension at the August and September FOMC meetings, a lot of kind of strong, you know, criticism. How do you think about Burns's actions at that time?
Well, first, I think you should look at this in a larger context.
Yeah.
I don't know any chairman of the Federal Reserve in the fall of a presidential campaign
mm-hmm.
who wanted to raise, who was eager to raise interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
That has the potential to create significantly political problems
mm-hmm.
for the central bank, disproportionate to the benefit it is likely to produce.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard chairman after chairman, in effect, say the kind of things that it would. Let's get through that. Let's get through the election. Let's,
mm-hmm.
You know, let's. Well, they never put it explicitly, but what the really feeling was, if we can avoid serious rocking of the boat just before a special mm-hmm. election, that's better for the Federal Reserve.
Mm. It's no time to draw attention to the Fed.
That's right. That's right. Now, and that is regardless of what party is in order and whatnot. So that's got, I think Burns had that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
I know Bill Martin had that feeling, and I bet Paul Volcker had that feeling. You know, I think that's an understandable attitude for a chairman to have in any one of those, in that season of the presidential election year, regardless of whether the chairman is Burns and the president is Nixon. Now, there are some people who were at the Federal Reserve meetings at that time who weren't aware that that's so almost a historical attitude for chairman of Federal Reserve banks mm-hmm. in the fall before an election,
mm-hmm.
who interpreted this as this kind of reluctance to move as it's political because Burns was an advisor to Nixon and he's close to Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
I think first and foremost it ought to be said that this was a traditional protect the Federal Reserve attitude mm-hmm. of Federal Reserve chairman in the fall of a presidential election year.
Mm-hmm.
And Burns had that kind of attitude. How much more than that there was, I can only say I didn't see any more of that.
Mm-hmm.
Not from where I sat, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are things I didn't see. I never went with him when he went over to the White House to talk to the White House people.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know I've forgotten whether it was the August or September one.
I didn't quite hear you.
I've forgotten which of those two FOMC meetings it was when we had such a difference of views that the chairman, Burns, called for a break.
Well, you know, that's never been clearly identified, but my guess is that was the January meeting, not the meetings right before the September.
Okay. My recollection can't place it particularly, but well, I know there was an episode where there was a division like that. Burns called for a break, picked up me and Alan Holmes, who was then the money market manager in New York, took us the door into his office and sat down. He said, let's work out a FOMC directory that'll pass in the light of everything we've heard.
Yeah, I think...
And I know that there are some people who were hot on other side of the issue who surmised, guessed, and eventually sort of thought it was so, that Burns used that time to call the White House and get his... and check.
Yeah.
And I never saw him pick up the phone all the time we were in that office.
Okay, no, I'm glad to have this on tape. That was the January... 1970 meeting. It was tense.
Early? Was it that early?
Yeah, well, it was...
1970?
No, I'm sorry. I've got that mixed up. 1972. And what the background is that you'd had the Smithsonian agreement in December of that year, and by the time of the next FOMC meeting, which was the end of January 1972, the Smithsonian agreement was unraveling. The dollar was under pressure.
Yeah.
You know, it looked like it might come apart. And Burns moved up the date of the regular FOMC meeting by a week and announced that there was going to be no discussion of the international situation. All they were going to do was concentrate on the domestic situation and money growth. And at that time, it looked like money growth had fallen well below the 6%. Level that the FOMC had targeted, and also the 6% that the Nixon administration thought it was going to get. And there were also a number of increases. So it was a meeting in which there was a lot of difference of opinion, and I'm almost, well, I'm just sure that was the meeting.
I don't remember the precise date. Boy, I do have a clear recollection of that episode. Mm-hmm. I'm just not sure in my own mind. Mm-hmm. It was somewhere in that, well...
What was so difficult to work out was that what Burns offered the committee in terms of alternatives for the directive were different, because the Maisel committee was supposed to report in March on the RPD business and whether they should use reserves, and Burns offered two alternatives. One was to move to reserve targeting immediately and provide for a generous increase in reserves that would push rates down to get money growing again, and the other alternative was to cut the funds rate rather significantly, and it had already been cut. And
I'll have to defer to your sense of the record and the dates and timings on this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You've got all the records there. You much in mind. If you had asked me what was the environment, I mean, I have a very clear recollection of this episode,
mm-hmm.
of us having not being able to reach an agreement around the table, Burns grabbing me and Alan and taking us into his office, and we worked out a compromise language we thought would pass, and we took it back and put it to the committee, and it did pass. And as I say, while we were in Burns' office, he didn't call anybody on the phone.
Right, but
and that, so that I remember that because that's the allegation that was made back. Now I don't remember when it was, but I do have a sense that it was not the issues you're describing that was going on. I have a sense it was more the issues of July and August than September of 1972, but I'm not sure.
Well, you know, I could be mistaken because the meeting has never been identified in terms of when it
took a break.
Yeah, what the article, the Rose article and the Sanford Rose article in Fortune didn't identify the date of the meeting, so it just said 1972, and so
I don't think the minutes show the break.
No.
In time, you know.
No, but the But the meeting where the strong debate occurs over the directive that's going to be adopted, and the meeting that seems to have the most sort of division, I just in reading the whole period, I just assumed it was the January 1972 meeting.
But
I may be wrong. I could be wrong.
Yeah.
Well,
I have to leave you with that ambiguity. My impression is it was the earlier atmosphere that surrounded that episode. I remember the episode clearly.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember the date. So the exact date. And so I leave it to you to...
So the language would have been over the monthly money benchmarks that were being given to the desk and how to make those consistent with the quarterly... figures for M1 growth
and the relative emphasis on that and on market conditions and so forth, interest rates and so forth. The relationship between them and so on.
Well, the main thing is your recollection of the break and, you know, the fact that you were involved with the chairman and Alan Holmes in writing the language, and people don't understand that this is a standard procedure, that after the go around, if there's difference of opinion, a lot of work is involved in getting a consensus and getting the right language, and that often there is a break in the meeting, the others go off and drink coffee, and the chairman is working with the secretary of the FOMC.
Yeah, the break is... It was unusual for a break to be as big and as long as that one, in my experience. We've often worked at it around the table,
mm-hmm.
maybe just a short break. That was that one was longer and more deliberate. But I do think this whole business of getting consensus out of the Federal Reserve, out of the FOMC through thick and thin, through mm-hmm. times is very almost, is very underappreciated by the market. In fact, I think I told you that we've been thinking about developing a book of essays in honor of Bill Martin.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And if we do, I think I'm going to write my essay on the difficulties of the importance of reaching consensus around that FOMC table and how hard it is, how hard it can be, and why it's so important. Well, the importance of it, and so on. You know, why it happens because of the structure of the system, da 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 da. I want to try to write an article that will put that in better perspective.
Well, that's actually where we began our discussion in terms of the relationship of the chairman to the committee, and really the Federal Reserve System, the committee, is very much modeled after the federal structure of government we have, where we don't have kind of rule by the philosopher king. We have government by consensus building and discussion, and it seems sort of inefficient, but when you've been through the system, you realize that ultimately decisions are better arrived at in that
process. Well, you're probably saying some of the words that I'm going to be putting in there. That's the kind of spirit I hope to do with this. I haven't got it written yet. I mean, started,
yeah.
But that's what I intend to try to write. If I get a draft done, I'll send it to you, Bob, for you to look over and to make comments.